Facebook launched a new app this week. It's called Rooms, but really, there's nothing new about it.
Think of it as a sort of mobile throwback to the internet of yesterday, when most of how we went online was AOL or chat rooms that you pick a username. So like football fan 1234, and you just start chatting away.
Mike Isaac is a tech reporter for the New York Times. The app allows you to choose from a variety of chat rooms. There's Photography Lovers Unite and Noms from Above. That's for food lovers, by the way. There's even one for finding the best parkour spots.
You connect with others about common interests, but you remain anonymous. You can take on a different identity in every room.
Say, I want to know more about an illness or some world problem, but I'm either too scared or embarrassed to talk about it in person.
Mike Isaac says this new spin on chat rooms also raises all of the previous concerns. With a truly open space come potential dangers, especially for younger users.
Isaac says there are safety settings, but there are still risks.
It is a little more free-for-all than, say, going on traditional Facebook and talking to people on there. And that's sort of dangerous as far as how can I protect my child from the craziness that is the internet these days.
This concept of multiple anonymous identities is a shift for Facebook. The company has come under fire for deleting the Facebook accounts of people who did not provide their real names.
They've realized there's much more room for who we are, and it's hard to sort of pigeonhole ourselves into one person online.
Facebook has also realized that it needs to do more to compete for people's attention. The company is trying here to take on the likes of Twitter and Reddit, but the Times' Mike Isaac says Rooms isn't much of a threat so far.
I would say Reddit and, you know, other little micro-communities aren't quite worried at this point. It's sort of like keeping a wary eye on what Facebook is doing.
Isaac says it's not clear whether the Rooms app will have the momentum to become the next, well, the next Facebook.
And you can chat with us anonymously or not at our Facebook page, NPRATC. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. We're chatting all day. The handle is the same, NPRATC. And you can chat with Robert, right? What's your handle?
RSiegel47. I actually tweeted today.
Actual tweets came out of that handle. And you can reach me at NPRAudie.
Never mind political technology. Advances in other technology mean that you, too, can be like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. That's the movie where she discovers how she can go home to Kansas.
Close your eyes and tap your heels together three times. And think to yourself, there's no place like
Soon, you too will be able to get home that easily. The new smartphone app, Dorothy, lets you control your smartphone with just a click of your heels.
It works whether you have Ruby slippers or not. A small chip device called Ruby slips into your shoe and communicates with your smartphone.
When you click your heels, the phone will do whatever you have programmed it to do. It may, for example, text your friends with locations so they know where to meet you.
Or it may cause your phone to ring so you can gracefully excuse yourself from a tedious meeting.
And soon the app will also be able to order you an Uber taxi so you can really click your heels and be on your way home.
In 1995, Jean-Dominique Bauby, editor of the French Elle magazine, suffered a massive stroke. He was left in a state known as locked-in syndrome, paralyzed physically, but mentally aware. He was only able to move his left eyelid and used it to dictate his memoir, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. Now we turn to a story about a patient who was left in a similar state, but learned to communicate with brain waves. In 2009, Barry Beck, a geologist in his 60s, had a series of strokes. They caused extensive damage to his right occipital lobe and to the brainstem.
According to the neurologist and the MRI scans, he had one of the worst cases of locked-in syndrome that they had seen.
That's Eric Sellers, a professor at East Tennessee State University. He and his team started working with Beck 10 months after his stroke.
When I first saw him, he had a little bit of eye movement, and that was really the only way that he could communicate.
Beck's wife contacted Sellers when she heard about the research he was doing. Sellers runs the Brain-Computer Interface Laboratory, where he focuses on helping people with severe motor disabilities to communicate. He and his team were working on a system to connect brainwaves and computers to make a virtual keyboard.
It's basically, instead of using your hands to press keys on the keyboard, you're using brainwaves to press the keys.
To use the system, you would wear a non-invasive electrode cap and sit in front of a monitor that has a picture of a keyboard. At random, groups of letters flash.
And if you want to choose the A, you pay attention to the A, and then every time the A flashes, your brain produces this response. It's called a P300. And this P300 is like an aha response. So your brain kind of says, aha, that's the one I want to select.
The technology has been used to help people with Lou Gehrig's disease compose messages. It's also allowed people to control wheelchairs and prosthetic limbs just by thinking. But Barry Beck was one of the first patients with a severe brainstem injury to use it successfully. Eric Sellers and his team started slow, with just four letters, Y for yes, N for no, P for pass, and E for end.
The first major interaction we had was a 25-question dialogue that ended up in us determining that he wanted more information regarding his prognosis.
Once they knew he was able to use it, they fine-tuned the settings and eventually presented him with a full alphabet so he could spell out words. Barry Beck could now communicate.
One of the first messages that he spelled was to his wife. He spelled out, "Thank you for all of your hard work." He, on a couple of occasions, also asked me to make the system go faster. And I of course, told him that I was trying. I'm doing my best.
That's because the system is slow, very slow. It took Beck 38 seconds to select each character. Much of Sellers' research now is focused on making the machine faster and more accurate. But for Beck, the painstaking task was worth it.
It was also something that gave his wife a lot of satisfaction, knowing that he was actually, you know, still in there and for the most part cognitively intact. His kids would visit while he used the BCI. And so it had a really large effect on the family as well.
Sellers and his team worked with Beck for more than a year, conducting therapy sessions in the nursing home where he lived. In November of 2011, at the age of 67, Barry Beck died. But Sellers says that through his participation, Barry Beck played a part in making this technology more accessible to other locked-in patients.
For the people that are participating in our research program, they understand that they may not benefit from this technology, but they also realize how important it could be for people who are in similar situations.
Sellers imagines a future where this technology is available in hospitals.
If someone has some type of injury, automobile accident or something like that, and they have to be intubated and on a respirator, you could imagine that emergency rooms, trauma wards, would actually have these.
Eric Sellers has documented his work with Barry Beck in a research paper published earlier this month in the journal Science Translational Medicine.
This week, NPR's tech team is exploring ways that new technology can change how we eat. And first up, how one of the world's smartest machines is bringing big data into the kitchen. IBM's Watson supercomputer can't taste a thing, but it was a great Jeopardy contestant with its vast database of facts about the world. Well, now some cooks are using Watson to come up with recipes they never would have tried on their own, as NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
I had a few things in the kitchen. I didn't know what to make with them. Ground turkey, frozen peas, dried mushrooms, canned tomatoes. I sent an email to IBM. I live in San Francisco. It's easy to get Asian and Mexican spices. A couple of days later, the recipes have arrived in my inbox, and I'm going to open them up. 3 Thai ground turkey taco recipes. And there's a second recipe. Ah, this is for my frozen peas. And we have Mexican green pea pancakes. I pick one of the taco recipes, and I'm going to make the pancakes, too. I need a quick shop.
Have a good night.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
The next morning, I set out to cook lunch for a friend.
It's 9:30 now. I have 3 hours. Let's cook. Some of the ingredients, like 1 1/4 ounce of grated citrus peel is definitely a little bit strange as something to put in a turkey taco, but I'm going to give it a try.
As I'm cooking, let's talk about how Watson came up with these recipes. When you taste food and you find it pleasant or not, there's a chemical reaction. Watson has a big database of what kinds of chemical reactions we humans like, says Stephen Abrams, an engineer with the Watson Group.
And if you can understand what's in an actual ingredient, so what is in butter, what's in strawberries, what's in chocolate, what are the key flavor compounds that give them those pleasant sensations, then you can make predictions about what's going to be pleasant, what's going to be sweet and spicy and salty and savory.
A great chef uses her personal knowledge and intuition to do this, says Abrams. But a human chef has her limits, especially when faced with certain constraints, if they're cooking for someone on a special diet or if there's a shortage of certain foods.
It might be that you want to improve the fat content or the calorie content, and it might be that what you want to do is focus less on certain fishes that may be overfished or maybe endangered and instead trade in other fishes.
And it isn't just engineers like Abrams who are excited about Watson. IBM's Watson is collaborating with the Institute of Culinary Education in New York. James Brissione, director of culinary development there, says among the recipes they developed with Watson...
Vietnamese apple kebab.
Brissione says Watson came up with an unusual flavor combination for the dish.
Chicken, pork, mushrooms, strawberries, and apples all share this one flavor compound, dodecalactone. That came out wrong. Gamma-dodecalactone. That's shared by all five ingredients, and it makes them a really fascinating match.
Brissione, who clearly knows cooking better than chemistry, says the dish is a hit. As for my Watson dishes...
Come on in. Lunch is ready.
I've invited my colleague, Aarti Shahani, over to taste the results.
One to taste first here. Okay, Aarti, this is Watson's recipe for Thai ground turkey taco.
Okay, great. So...
And...
It's very good.
Is it?
Yeah.
So Watson did okay? Yeah?
Yeah, because usually turkey doesn't taste like anything. It just tastes like something.
Then we try the Mexican pea pancakes. The pancakes are made from grated potato, flour, and the dried mushrooms. Then there's a sauce that uses the peas that you pour over it.
I like it. I like the mushroom in this.
Really?
Yeah.
But in the end, Aarti and I feel like something's missing. Yes, putting mushrooms in the pancakes is nice. The citrus flavor in the turkey is interesting, but...
I mean, it's not fine dining, for sure. That's not about the cook.
Still, this is a major leap for a computer. Computers don't normally synthesize information and create things from scratch, says Sean Gourley, the founder and CEO of the data analytics company Quid.
We're all sort of familiar with this idea of I can recommend... a book for you to read, or I can recommend a song to listen to. But this seems quite different from, let me create a new kind of recipe. Let me create a new combination of foods that will be novel and tasty.
Most importantly, Gourley says being able to access vast amounts of data about food could change how we cook and eat.
We've only been kind of at this kind of whole agricultural cooking game for, a few thousand years, right? And we've only explored a small piece of it. So with computers, helping us, perhaps there's a whole lot more to uncover.
As for me, when I said goodbye to my colleague, Aarti Shahani, after lunch, only one thing went through my mind. When will Watson be able to do the dishes? Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Now to some potentially painful memories. Old AOL Instant Messenger screen names. 2 weeks ago on All Tech, as part of our series about millennials, we asked you to reach way back and recall your instant messenger days. This was huge in the late 90s and early aughts.
Well, many of you bravely shared old screen names with us, and here are a few, starting with NerdIam16. That's the one-time online alias of Hatali Ladaya of San Antonio, Texas. She writes that it combined a Dr. Seuss reference, my birthday, and a very strong self-identification with nerddom.
Sarah Vanderplug of Chicago says hers was Viola Chick. She writes, this clearly shows my middle school naivete. As much as I love the viola, it has never been cool.
Hey, I'm a viola player, and I resent that comment. Lillian Goebel of Carmel, New York, went by Queen of Graves. She writes, in seventh grade, I thought that there was nothing cooler than a spoonful of angst.
Lana McGinnis of San Diego tried to pull a fast one with the name, I'm Oprah, seriously. Seriously, in all caps. And she confesses, I would occasionally go into AIM chat rooms and announce that I was giving away free cars to everyone. Surprisingly, there were some people who seemed to believe it was true. So if anyone out there is still waiting to hear back from Oprah about that free car she offered them in an AIM chat room 10 years ago, I sincerely apologize.
Only a partial confession from Claire McInerney of Bloomington, Indiana. Her screen name was Agent Giggle Chunk, and she warns, don't ask me the backstory.
And we got even less from Alexa Tipton of New York City. 7 years later, she writes, and I'm still too embarrassed to share. When tech enthusiasts go to the store, they'd love to leave their wallets behind and pay with mobile phones instead. For companies such as Apple and Google, this seems like an obvious opportunity. But breaking into the mobile wallet business is proving much harder than many expected. Google Wallet was introduced a few years ago. It flopped. And now the much-hyped Apple Pay has hit a stumbling block. CVS and Rite Aid announced over the weekend that they will not accept Apple's new payment system. To explain why, NPR's Steve Henn joins us now. He covers technology for Planet Money. And Steve, what went wrong here? Why won't these drugstore chains let Apple fans pay with their phones?
Well, I have a one-word answer. Money.
Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So Apple Pay works on top of Visa and MasterCard. You know, this is the same system that we all use all the time when we go into a store and make a credit card purchase. Now, for years, merchants everywhere, from Walmart to your tiny little local coffee shop, have kind of hated this system because there's a transaction fee built into it that takes 3% of the purchase price. And if you think about it, merchants take trillions of dollars of transactions every year on credit cards. Mm-hmm. So this adds up to tens of billions of dollars in fees that go directly to Visa and MasterCard. They were hoping that systems like Apple Pay would introduce some competition into this market. But instead, Apple built its system on top of credit card companies.
So these are retailers who actually have been in a consortium developing an alternative to Apple Pay, which I gather is called Currency, and that would not use our credit cards? That would access our bank accounts directly?
That's right. So a few years ago, a huge group of merchants, including Walmart, Target, CVS, Rite Aid, many gas stations, got together to try and build their own electronic payment system that would circumvent Visa and MasterCard. That would save merchants a lot on fees. The other thing that these merchants really want is they want the data that's collected when you go into the store and make a purchase. So they've spent years developing their own system. It's a little awkward. It uses something called a QR code, which is like a hashed up barcode. And people are skeptical whether or not it will be attractive to users.
Well, does the fact that Apple, a company synonymous with making things that are attractive to users, has lost these two big retail drug chains, is that bad news for the entire idea of the virtual wallet?
Well, you know, I think it's going to be interesting to watch this play out. There are some huge companies that are part of this consortium. CVS and Rite Aid are really relatively small in comparison. If all of these merchants decide to abandon Apple Pay, I think they're large enough to kill it. But many seem to be playing along so far. And consumers who use this and are interested in paying with their phones seem to like the system. So I think over the next 6 months to 8 months, we're really going to see whether or not Apple Pay takes off and merchants feel like they have to take it or lose business, or if it dies.
But Steve, here's my real question. I understand what's in it here for Apple. I understand what's in it for the merchants, what might have been in it for Google. But really, for consumers who can use a debit card and then swipe it and then enter a brief code, is there really a great advantage of being able to reduce it, to make that transaction time that much shorter?
Well, that's one of the reasons that all of these efforts have struggled. It's not that hard to pay with a credit card. Mm-hmm. And to create an obviously better system for consumers is a really high bar.
Thank you, Steve.
My pleasure.
It's Steve Henn of NPR's Planet Money team.